The next item on the programme is the part that you're waiting for his address. So now I have pleasure in asking John to address.
Well, I think you all heard an awful lot of, from me recently, so I don't want to be very long on this occasion. But it's an opportunity again to meet with the members of our society and share a few ideas.
Sometimes when one goes around,
one no longer remembers exactly what one has already said. So I must beg your indulgence if you think I'm repeating myself. But I feel I can't let the opportunity go by without referring once again to that very extraordinary letter called the Mahachon's letter, which we received in 1881, and which for many students of the society has been a sort of marching orders or something of that sort. It is a letter which is extraordinarily frank and deals quite a number of times in the course of the letter with the kind of work which it seems is expected of us within the society. For instance, there's a part of the letter here in which the writer of the letter has spoken of being interested in humanity as a whole, and goes on to say, if the Theosophists say we have nothing to do with all this, the lower classes and the inferior races cannot concern us and must manage as best they can, what becomes of our fine professions of benevolence, philanthropy, and reform? Are these professions a mockery? And if a mockery, can ours be the true path? Should we devote ourselves to teaching a few Europeans, fed on the fat of the land, many of them loaded with the gifts of blind fortune, and leave the teeming millions of the ignorant, of the poor and despised, the lowly and the oppressed, to take care of themselves and of their hereafter as best they know how? Never. Rather perish the Theosophical Society with both its hapless founders than if we should permit it to become no better than an academy of magic or a hall of occultism. That we, the devoted followers of that spirit incarnate of absolute self-sacrifice, of philanthropy and divine kindness, as of all the highest virtues attainable on this earth of sorrow, that man of man, Gautama Buddha, that we should ever allow the Theosophical Society to represent the embodiment of selfishness, the refuge of the few, with no thought in them for the many, is a strange idea, my brother. And then he goes on to speak of the bodhisattvas, the great teachers who have renounced their nirvana, renounced the attainment of Buddhahood, the Buddhahood, the summum bonum of bliss and of individual personal felicity, that they might be born again and again for the benefit of mankind. And then he becomes, again, just a little bit mocking, not exactly the right word, but something like that. In other words, that they might be again and again subjected to misery, imprisonment in the flesh, and all the sorrows of life, provided that by such a self-sacrifice, repeated throughout long and dreary centuries, they might become the means of securing salvation and bliss in the hereafter for just a handful of men, chosen amongst but one of the many races of mankind. And it is we, the humble disciples of these perfect lamas, who are expected to allow the Theosophical Society to drop its noble title, that of the Brotherhood of Humanity, to become a simple school of psychology. No, no, good brothers, you have been laboring under the mistake too long already. Let us understand each other. He who does not feel competent enough to grasp the noble idea sufficiently to work for it need not undertake a task too heavy for him. But there is hardly a Theosophist in the whole society unable effectually to help it by correcting the erroneous impressions of the outsiders, if not by actually propagating himself the idea. So, there's no question, you see, there is no question that in the minds of those who were behind the founding of this society, our job is not merely to benefit ourselves, but to help the world. And that, I think, we have got to understand. And that our work, wherever that work may lie, has got to have as its motive the spreading of the ageless wisdom amongst those who as yet do not know anything about it. Now, in the beginning, there was of course a very close relationship between some of the older brothers and our founders. And we find, for instance, this quotation: "These were certainly wonderful days, with the masters giving close guidance on the general lines of the work to be done. They directed the editorial policy of the Theosophist." I wish to goodness, as editor of the Theosophist, they would do that today. But I'm afraid I don't know all their wishes, unfortunately. "And sometimes one of them would even dictate an article for it. When Mr. Hume wrote his criticism of the Mahatmas for the Theosophist, H.P. Blavatsky, as editor, refused to publish it, but she was ordered to do so by the Mahachon himself, who was Master Morios and K.H. Superior. Personal opinions and criticisms, however unfavorable, must not be suppressed." So it is good for us to know the difficulties and to know what we're up against. We should not always expect praise, we should listen to criticism in order that perhaps we can learn something from it. And then another point which Madame Blavatsky makes very clearly, and which is corroborated in the letters of Master K.H., is this business of the end of the century. "Let every member know that the time for such priceless acquisitions," that means growth of a spiritual kind, "is limited. The writer of the present is old, her life is well nigh worn out, and she may be summoned home any day and almost any hour. And if her place is ever filled up, perchance by another worthier and more learned than herself, there still remain but 12 years to the last hour of the term, namely till December the 31st, 1899. Those who will not have profited by the opportunity given to the world in every last quarter of a century, those who will not have reached a certain point of psychic and spiritual development, or that point from which begins the cycle of adeptship by that day, those will advance no further than the knowledge already acquired. No master of wisdom from the East will himself appear or send anyone to Europe or America after that period. And the sluggards will have to renounce every chance of advancement in their present incarnation until the year 1975. Such is the law, for we are in Kali Yuga, the Black Age, and the restrictions in this cycle, the first 5,000 years of which will expire in 1897, are great and almost insuperable." So you see, we live in an age in which things are not expected to be too easy. Everything is a little more difficult than it might normally be, and everything is therefore a greater challenge to us, requiring more work, perhaps, than we normally are happy to give. We are now at the end of another century, and we can therefore expect a manifestation of some kind of effort whereby the elders can offer once more to humanity some aid, some help, some idea which will bring us all along a little further on the way. And just as the preparations for the Theosophical Society in the last century started a long time before the society was actually founded, so we may feel sure that preparations for the end of this century must have started quite a number of years ago, and not only in 1975. And so we should be awake, we should be aware, we should be looking around us to see what has been happening that is really new in these last years through which we've been living. We can all find many things that are new. Let us all think about that, perhaps have a discussion about it sometime in the lodge. What we feel are the evidences of something new which is starting around this particular time in history, and things which may perhaps make possible a real change in the thinking of human beings around the world. We may find it in science, in technology. We may find it through the interest in Eastern philosophy and yoga. We may find it in the bridge being built by parapsychology to science. We may find it in many things all around the world today. Let us keep our eyes open. And if we are, as a society, closely involved in it, good. If we are not, let us help it along. We have to remember that the great elder brothers are not sentimentalists. If we deserve to be included in the effort, we shall be included in the effort. If we don't work in such a way as to make us appear useful in that effort, very probably others will be utilized instead of us. We have to accept that in a perfectly common sense manner. So it behoves us as individuals and groups to make ourselves useful, to make our light shine, so to speak, so that it has to be noticed. This means, therefore, I feel that in these next years we have to make a special effort to reach out. Not expect everyone to come to us, but to reach out to them. We have been changing the format of the Theosophist, as some of you would see, because for many, many years now we have never had more than about 1,900 subscribers, usually less than that. And in a membership of something like 35,000, this is too little. Allowing for language difficulties, many of our members don't read English easily, and for the delay in delivery and so on, we really should have a far larger subscribing membership. And perhaps, therefore, it is right to change the format and perhaps some of the content to make it, we hope, a little more interesting. Maybe more people will then be interested to read it. We shall get more subscribers, and it may be of a nature that can be more easily passed on to others. We might one day also start some magazine which will reach out, particularly possibly to the younger people who are in so many cases being led astray by what I would call pseudo-occultism. And we have nothing in the field in which they meet, which they usually move, which can help them to understand that there are deeper ways of looking at this particular way of life. We have, I think, a great duty there, and we should fail in our duty if we were not making an effort in that direction. There has been much talk in recent years of the generation gap, and one deplores this. It's a great pity that it should be, and we shouldn't emphasize it, but we have to reckon with it and realize that in certain places it does in fact exist. And I was telling them in New Plymouth, where we had an Easter weekend of an occasion in Adyar in December, when I had at the same table three elderly members from London and two young Americans, and they were discussing the Theosophist. And never in my life have I had such a demonstration of the generation gap. It was really, if it hadn't been so sad, it would have been extremely funny. The Americans couldn't believe that the British could be so stuffy. They simply couldn't believe that they were so narrow-minded and so conservative, you see. They just couldn't understand it. Something so utterly different from California, if you see what I mean. And the British people, they didn't know what those young Americans were talking about. They didn't understand their language. I don't mean to say their accent, but their reference to energies and things, their vibrations and so on and so on. A lot of new words, you see, which young people use in many parts of the world, they didn't know what they were talking about. There was a complete generation gap between them, complete. It was really sad, but it was also quite funny. So evidently it exists still. And whereas we can smile and all that at the idea, we ought to look into our own eyes maybe and see whether perhaps we still have a kind of a generation gap when we're young and are thinking about the old, or when we're old and thinking about the young. Let us remember that at all costs we should try and bridge that gulf for the sake of universal brotherhood. Now, Madame Blavatsky, in one occasion, and I'm still talking really about the young, said that the society as a body has no creed, as creeds are but the shells around spiritual knowledge, and theosophy in its fruition is spiritual knowledge itself, the very essence of philosophical and theistic inquiry. She goes on in the same line for a while, and then says, the attainment of these objects, all agree, can best be secured by convincing the reason and warming the enthusiasm of the generation of fresh young minds that are just ripening into maturity and making ready to take the place of their prejudiced and conservative fathers. Now, I find that interesting, and that's HBB. Long time ago, long before Everyone talked about a generation gap. Dr. Besant, the thoughts of young boys and girls represents the future. They may be crude. Their thoughts will be in advance of the thoughts of the average older person who tends to represent his thinking as the principal thought of the day. The young people will very often be unreasonable, hasty, impatient, but they are the citizens of tomorrow. Advise them sometimes about action, but never check their free speech. Let them say exactly what they like. Most of us will be cremated and in our graves whilst they are working. The more they can think and discuss while they are working, the more they will learn. Let them be over-enthusiastic. The world might kill that soon enough. Encourage them to give themselves great ideals, and you will build up the, in this case, she says, the America of the future. She was talking to the Americans. That is the kind of sympathy that they need from us. The young will not express themselves before their elders, and the less you say don't to them, the better. I find that, again, a very good thought for today. And that's true within the movement as outside it. Now, when I was reading the Mahachan's letter, I had been going to read the point where they speak about the Theosophical Society as having been chosen. Here it is. The Theosophical Society was chosen as the cornerstone, the foundation of the future religions of humanity. Very interesting. What are we doing about it, I wonder? And then here again, we get a similar, a totally different subject, but a similar reference to the society. It is really supposed to have been written by one of the masters, although under a pseudonym. Until the age of 7, the skeletons of girls do not differ in any way from those of boys, and the osteologist would be puzzled to discriminate between them. Woman's mission is to become the mother of future occultists, of those who will be born without sin. On the elevation of woman, the world's redemption and salvation hinge, and not till woman bursts the bonds of her sexual slavery, to which she has ever been subjected, will the world obtain an inkling of what she really is and of her proper place in the economy of nature. The light that will come to the world at large when the latter shall discover and really appreciate the truths that underlie this vast problem of sex will be like, quote, the light that never shone on sea or land, unquote, and has to come to men through the Theosophical Society. There now. And yet, I remember the days in the Theosophical lodges when I was younger, where if you mentioned the word sex, everybody simply threw a fit. True. Everyone was horrified. You can't talk about sex in the Theosophical Society. No. It was most ridiculous, of course, but it was like that. And I trust it isn't like that in HBB lodge. And I hope that perhaps the president of the lodge will instigate an investigation into this field. If it has to come through the Theosophical Society, why shouldn't it come through the HBB Lodge in New Zealand? Why not? Don't let us be afraid of it. If the master says it has to come through the theater, let's see what we can do about it. That light will lead on and up to the true spiritual intuition. And then the world will have a race of Buddhas and Christs. For the world will have discovered that individuals have it in their own power to procreate Buddha-like children or demons. And when that knowledge comes, all dogmatic religions, and with these the demons, will die out. Yeah, there's a wonderful prophecy for us. May we fulfill it, as evidently it is hoped of us. Why should we share it? We have to be careful what traps we fall into. I was talking about this also in New Plymouth. I have a friend who runs an organization, which is a very fine organization. I won't mention either him or his organization, because that's not fair. And he's really very dedicated and devoted, but he is, in my opinion, gullible. Traveling around the world, he found himself, not very long ago, in Seattle, in the United States. And there, he was given a tape recording, which was purported to come from Master K.H., and a whole shower of little stones, which it was said were semi-precious stones sent specially from Shambhala to help him in his work. Now, he accepted all that as gospel truth, so to speak. I happen to know two women in South America, in South Africa, who've been given these little stones with great reverence and highly magnetized, etc., and took them to jewelers to have rings made. And in each case, the jeweler said, "Why? These are only little pieces of glass." Now, he should have known, you see, and we should all know that, if I may dare to talk about Shambhala, which is a word that in India sometimes people won't even pronounce because they regard it so holy, Shambhala wouldn't send pieces of glass through a medium in Seattle. I mean, the standard of the great masters is so tremendously high, and they don't do that kind of thing. See, and if we believe it, it's because we've never taken the trouble to find out the way they work and the way they live. If we would read their letters and understand the way they think, what they say about it, you would know, we would know for ourselves that they don't do that kind of thing, and we could avoid those traps. The tape recording, I was asked to listen to it, and one really felt, with all due respect to anyone else, I really felt about half a minute, I felt, I don't think this is the master. It didn't sound like him. His English was very poor, and his English in all his letters that we have is extraordinarily good. Nor can I believe that he would use a medium after all he said about mediums in his letters in the past. So, don't let us fall into these traps, you see, by immediately accepting everything we hear as though it was absolutely true. The very first step on the path is discrimination, and we have to use it all the time. We are surrounded by all kinds of false values, psychic ideas, which belong to the world of form and time and not to the world of the eternal. And we must be for all times concerned not to allow ourselves or our groups or our lobbies to become embroiled in something which is below the standard. We have to learn that standard and try and keep with it. And if the society is to survive usefully, we shall have to be very alert, I think, very objective, impersonal, and careful not to become unwisely involved. This means, then, a constant awareness of our own actions and reactions, our own feelings and thoughts and habits, not just to become introspective and interested in ourselves, I don't mean that, but aware of what we are doing when we're doing it, what we're thinking when we're thinking it, what we're joining when we're joining it. So we have to look very carefully at all we do. Now, there has been much talk in my tour around this country of the Theosophical Order of Service. I know that at a certain period some years ago there were some problems with regard to the Order of Service in this country, but I hope that just as it flourishes very successfully in a great many countries all around the world, I hope that it will continue to resuscitate itself here and become equally effective in New Zealand as it is in other countries. It was started, for those who might not know, by Dr. Besant in order to provide opportunities for members to put into practice their ideas of brotherhood without involving the Theosophical Society itself as such, which must always remain, as it were, apart or rather around all such efforts without being associated too closely with any of them. Now, this order of service is concerned with all sorts of activities which I think might be of use to the world. And in relation to that pamphlet recently issued regarding the campaign for compassion, a protest against cruelty, one has here a number of ideas drawn from that pamphlet, essentially, as to what we might do. Surely we could accept that if we are purporting to be anxious to promote universal brotherhood, we cannot fail to be interested in activities in its service. So there has to be an education of oneself to compassion and understanding. by the observation of our motives and our reactions, I just said. Meditating on goodness, the development in the consciousness of the oneness of all life, the practice of altruism, of compassion and sympathy. Education with regard to young people, by parents, by schools, the choice of literature and shows, teaching respect for nature and all that lives, from the stone, the plant, the animal and man, a change in television programs, clubs of goodness, education of the public, radio, television, press, literature, shows, the highest human values in culture, and leave out of the programs all calls to violence. Stress the influence of music on the emotions. Healing, preventing psychic deterioration. Shift the accent in love from sexuality to sentiment. Birth control instead of abortion. Opposition to alcoholism, drugs, which are sources of violence and cruelty. Support the contact with nature, which makes people happy and peaceful. The abolishment of cruelty to animals. Legal protection for domestic animals. Saving the natural homes of wild animals. Fighting against pollution of seas and rivers. The abolition of hunting, perhaps fishing. The replacement of pesticides by ecologically harmless means. Vivisection can be replaced by methods of treatment without experimenting on animals. The development of artificial tissue upon which experiments can be made. Waking up human consciousness to renounce a longer life at the price of cruelty to animals. Dr. Arundel, one of the presidents of our society, could have prolonged his life, I'm sure, if he would have taken insulin, but he wouldn't take it because it was an animal product. The propagating of vegetarianism not only saves animals from suffering, but which can feed larger populations and put a stop to the sufferings of malnutrition and the artificial reduction of births. The abolition of fights between animals, like cockfighting and so on. Respect and reconstitution of nature, fight the pollution of rivers and seas, replanting on a world scale, specially comestible fruit-producing trees, nut trees, protection of forests, natural parks. Food can feed a larger population, and raw food can feed a larger population than cooked. Food is wasted by making alcohol from corn and fruit, and this constitutes a crime towards undernourished populations. See also the production of drugs, tobacco, and even tea and coffee, when a great part of the population is hungry. A lot of food is used for nourishing animals which will later be slaughtered. Close contact with nature is a sort of inner harmony and peace. So encourage the people living in the country rather than always in the concrete jungle. Abolition of cruelty towards man. War, nuclear weapons, bacteriological, toxic weapons, all kinds of aggression, torture, slavery, the taking of hostages, concentration camps, political prisoners, deportations, antagonism between different races of men, the oppression of racial minorities, of religious and linguistic minorities. The influence of governments towards the protection of animals and nature. Replace the sense of competition amongst men and people by the ideal of the greatest good for the greatest number, a philosophy of wholeness. And so on and so on, I won't read it all. But here, the order of service exists to encourage our members who may not as yet be doing something to do something to help along the brotherhood of the world. So there is masses to choose from, and no one need say, I don't know what to do. Because every one of us knows. And there is a statement by one of the masters with regard to the fact that where there is suffering and injustice and unhappiness and cruelty, there we should find the members of our society. So in that time at least, they regarded it as their society. So we need to watch ourselves and watch perhaps our habits, many of which grow upon us without our realizing what they are. Mr. W. Q. Judge, who is responsible, I think, unfortunately, for a schism in the Theosophical Society in 1896. He died almost immediately, but that actually was the time when the Theosophical Society of Point Loma was founded as separate from the Theosophical Society of Adyar, to which we all belong. And Mr. Judge was one of the original founders in 1875, and worked to build up the Theosophical Society in the United States. And he was a very good writer, and he wrote many splendid things. He was a very wise theosophist, and although we may regret the fact that he left the society, he certainly has helped us a great deal with his writings, his books, and so on, and they're worth reading. Here I have listed a number of theosophical don'ts which Mr. Judge evidently once laid before his members. Don't speak or write as if morality and ethics were unknown before HPB wrote The Voice of the Silence. Some of our devoted band have been heard to speak in such a way that hearers thought the speaker meant to convey the idea that only in The Voice of the Silence or other similar books of ours could be found the high and correct ethics by which one ought to guide his life. Buddhism, Christianity, and all the other religions teach the same morals, and literature is full of it. Well, if you ever thought of falling into that trap, don't. Don't say that all theosophical doctrines were first given out by the Mahatmas through their theosophical chelas. Attributing everything solely to the Mahatmas is foolish, as it is easily controverted. Do not be forever saying, "We are taught this and told that." For the number of doctrines found mentioned for the first time by the Mahatmas through HPB are very few, extraordinary in conception and scope, and easily recognized. Don't explain everything by one theory. Do not be so inadequate as to brush off the whole of spiritualism, for instance, with one word. You will be wrong if you do so, and the result will be antagonism. Don't say that science is all wrong, and that men of science are materialists. Huxley, it's T.H. Huxley, has done us a good service. He has but lately admitted consciousness to be the third factor in the universe, not a part of force or matter. And Spencer has many a good thing in his works. Besides, if you want HPB on the matter, you can read her words that the truth is to be found in a union of science with occultism. Don't think or say that phenomena are good stepping stones to theosophy. They are not, for those who stand upon them will fall from them to their hurt. Do not run down the spirit of true Christianity, nor imagine that we can get ministers and congregations en masse to change into theosophists. The true spirit of Christianity as meant to be taught in the beginning is doubtless theosophy, but truth is not aided by running amok amongst the faith of a whole people. And there are more of that same sort. It's very interesting and very useful not to fall into these traps. We have to be most objective and common sense people if we're really going to be useful in the field. And now, as time is rushing on, I think, amongst other things, that we have to change ourselves and our outlooks very much indeed. There is another standard and another way of looking at things. And where we have an opportunity to come in contact with such things, I think we should think about them rather seriously. Now, here is one such. It comes from the pen of a good lady whom I knew when she was already nearly 90, called Miss Marie Poots, and she was the head of part of our work in the United States and the Americas for many, many years. As she got older, the members used to think, "Oh, poor Miss Poots, she has to be looked after very well, and she mustn't have any strong coffee anymore, it's not good for her," and so on. She was brought up on coffee in Louisiana, incidentally, but she loved coffee, and so she was always saying, "From the unreal, lead me to the real," with regard to coffee, and she had a great sense of humor. A great sense of humor. And here, from her pen, obviously a problem to her, which she thought she had found a solution to. You may or may not agree with it. There are some points in it that I find just a little bit obscure. But here it is. "For a number of years, I have been sorely puzzled over the problem of right and wrong. Questions which I could not silence had been repeatedly forcing their way into my consciousness. Was there really anything like right and wrong? Had morality a place in the plan of the Logos for the universe? The agony of the questioning was all the greater because it came when my thought turned to those who have transcended humanity. For they seemed to condone what the commandments given by some amongst themselves forbid men to do. It seemed even in some cases as if those whom they chose to admit into their ranks earned that privilege by apparent mistakes and wrongdoing. And we read of the Christ blessing Mary the sinner and rebuking Martha, whose faithful work made it possible for Mary to sit at the feet of her Lord. Are then moral laws given to men solely for the purpose of keeping the little ones quiet? As my landmarks grew dim in the darkness, an overwhelming pity for the little ones filled my heart, and a grim determination to sacrifice all to help them, even my conscience if necessary. One day, in meditation, light came. I heard within myself these words: when confronted with a moral problem, men still centered in the ego ask, is it right? Those who have transcended the ego consciousness ask, is it love? That means the consciousness of the mind and the consciousness of good. Those who have transcended it ask, is it love? As the meaning of those words began to unfold, I saw how the higher vision no longer deals with moral problems in terms of right and wrong, but in terms of love and not love. The human moral code makes a horizontal division, the clean above and the unclean below. But the divine moral code makes a vertical division, the clean and the unclean on the love side, and the clean and the unclean on the not love side. On the love side, not only the beautiful spiritualized emotions that grace evolved humanity, but also the primitive and untransmuted stages of those emotions, debauchery, profligacy, rape, theft, the love of the drunkard for his liquor, all in short that has in itself some element of love for something or somebody outside, yearning for union with the self without. On the not love side, we find not only pride, anger, hatred, condemnation, self-love, but also spotless purity, too white to suffer the proximity of mud, and perchance deeds of heroic self-sacrifice, unwarmed by love, done simply because it was right. Further than that, the not love may not go, and those who have reached that stage have to be swept into the current of love, which is the fulfilling of the law. And who dare say how many ages it may take and how many lives of suffering and agony. Hence, those who are already on the love side, however soiled their manifestation of love may be, are on the more direct road to the highest. Their possibilities of rapid transmutation are greater. And those who know how quickly the sinner may become the saint have always blessed and absolved the Magdalene and the publican. In their sight, the immoral man who lives a life of kindness towards his fellow men is greater than the man of irreproachable conduct who looks down upon his brother with the cold eye of criticism and contempt. Not because they condone immorality, but because they know what flower of great price will soon grow out of the mud and send forth the fragrance of God's very love. And people whom I knew, and she knew very many and had to deal with them all the time, began to classify themselves. Men and women whom I had condemned were on the side of love, and others whom I had admired were on the other side, in spite of their splendid achievements, because of their lack of sympathy and understanding. And now I think I understand the parable of Mary and Martha, and I am at peace. For I believe that I have caught a glimpse of the measuring standard of those who are more than man. And when confronted by the moral problems of daily life, I am humbly learning to ask, not is it right, but is it love? Now, I find there's a tremendous teaching in that. Obviously, in the wrong hands, you could make it into an excuse for doing anything you want. But that's not the point. Obviously, that's not the point. Is there not a higher standard of judging people than the one that we normally use? And I think perhaps there is. So within this movement of ours, we are here to change and to be changed. As a matter of fact, if we don't change ourselves, life usually changes us by the hard way. This is what we more or less demand of karma by coming into this movement and associating ourselves with that great ageless wisdom which is seeking at all times to express itself and find means of expression in this world of darkness in which we live. Now, way back, I've come to the end now, way back in 1906, there was a great argument going on in the Theosophical Society. As I said to the new members at the beginning, we're only human and we have our failings, and we had a great argument. And members took sides in this argument. Some thought that one of the leaders had been doing what he shouldn't have done, and others thought he was a very innocent person and had been misjudged. And people took sides. And it was quite a problem for poor Colonel Olcott, who was trying to keep the peace. And he was very ill in 1906, and he died in February 1907. And he was in bed most of the time. And he had a friend called Mrs. Russock, who was an opera singer from the United States, and he asked her to come out to Adyar to help him, and she did. And it was Mrs. Russock who told us about this happening, because she was present at the time. In fact, she told us of several occasions in which some of the elder brothers visited Colonel Olcott on his sick bed. In this case, the Colonel was trying to prepare an article about all this problem. And he said to Mrs. Russock, "I wonder how on earth I can end off this article." And as he said that, a voice spoke, as it were, from nowhere and said, "I'll finish it for you." And Master M and Master Cage came into the room, their room, which we have now in Adyar, which is used as a sort of rather special place, you see, not exactly a museum, but a special place within the building of headquarters. And Mrs. Russick was so surprised, she told us, she said, "I dropped my pencil on the floor," which is not surprising, I suppose. And Master M picked up the pencil and put it into her hand and said, "Write." I expect he said it with a firmer voice than that. He probably said, "Write." As he's said to be extraordinarily determined and direct. And this is what he wrote. "Let those who believe in our existence and that we are behind the Theosophical movement, also that we shall continue to employ it as an agency for the uplifting of mankind, let them all know that we are sometimes forced to employ imperfect instruments for our work because of the lack of perfect ones. Therefore, cease from such turmoil and strife and from causing disturbance in the real unity of brotherhood and thus weakening its strength. But instead, work together in harmony to fit yourselves to be useful instruments to aid us instead of impeding our work. We who are behind the Theosophical movement are powerless sometimes to prevent the checks and disturbances that must unavoidably arise because of the karma of individual members. But you can aid us much by refusing to take part in such disturbances and by living true to the highest possible ideals of Theosophy. Should any event bring forth seeming injustice, have faith in the law that never fails to adjust matters. Cease rushing headlong into strife or taking part in dissension, but hold together in brotherly love, since you are all part of the great universal self. Are you not striving against yourselves? Are not your brother's sins your own? Peace, and have trust in us." And I think that is also an extremely interesting communication. It is true, it goes back many years. But at that time at least, they admitted in more than one place that the society was their instrument and that it existed for the uplift of humanity. I see no reason to think that they have withdrawn completely from their interest in our society. We are still, I believe, meant to be the instrument whereby they who are behind the Theosophical movement can help to uplift mankind. That, I think, is a challenge, the inner challenge, you might say, before each one of us, and an indication of how we should try to live in order to be really useful in that enduring work which goes on from generation to generation to help all our brethren around the world to understand something more of what they are and who they are, and finally to set their feet on the path which leads to freedom, to peace, and to the realization that all is one.
And that concludes the address by Mr. John Coates. And Mr. Neil Edgar, the president of the New Zealand section, is going to give his thanks and his farewell to Mr. Coates.
Cecilia and fellow members, it's my great privilege to be able to express thanks to John Coates for the wonderful work that he has done during this very extensive tour of New Zealand. These tours don't start off just overnight. This one started something like 15 or 18 months ago when John first intimated that he was willing to come and visit us. And during the course of last year, there was an exchange of correspondence. I wrote to John and asked whether, since he was prepared to make so much time available, whether he would be willing to go to some of the smaller lodges and groups throughout the country. And John replied to the effect that he'd be very happy to. So based on that, I set to work and prepared, as one or two of you might already know, an itinerary which scheduled him to every whistle stop there was around the country. And John very kindly replied to this in due course and said that thank you, he would be very pleased to meet this itinerary in its fullness. He just hoped that I wouldn't mind if he died halfway through. So, needless to say, I had to turn around then and revise the itinerary. I couldn't see that I could carry on with the original one very well. And so I chopped out this and I chopped out that, and I gave him extra days of rest here and there, and toned it down considerably and resubmitted it. And John very kindly accepted that one. And at the start of his tour, unfortunately, to my great regret, I wasn't in the country. I was over in Australia. I sent down business. And when he first arrived, and during my absence, John looked at this itinerary and said, goodness gracious me, what am I going to do with all the spare time? So he promptly filled it all up again. And the net result is that he's done the original tour. He doesn't quite realise it, but he's done the original tour. It has been a very extensive tour. As many of you all know, he started here in Auckland. It's about 6 weeks ago now since he started. And he did several lectures and members' meetings here. He attended various other functions. He went out to Orewa and dedicated for us our new meeting rooms out at Orewa, and attracted a magnificent audience of 109, which would be just about on par, I should think, with what we have here tonight. Certainly a very big audience for a relatively small lodge. They wouldn't have anything like 109 members. And he went to Whangarei. He did a very good lecture out there, I understand, to quite a packed hall. Mr. John Sill was kind enough to take him up and conduct him through that part of his tour. And then he came back, I think did another lecture here, and then set off, and he did Hamilton, Tauranga, Gisborne, Napier, Hastings. Hastings wasn't on the schedule, but he poked that in. Palmerston North, Wellington. Wellington, incidentally, the hall was so crowded that folk were standing at the back, there just was not seating available for them. Went across to Nelson, an audience I understand of 60 in Nelson, which I should think would be the largest audience that the Theosophical Society has ever had in Nelson. From Nelson, we had planned to fly him down to Christchurch, And we had two options. We could either send him on a direct hippity-skippity flight, which went to Westport and Hokitika and eventually across to Christchurch, or we could have sent him back to Wellington and catch another plane, quite, you know, change of plane. And we decided we wouldn't risk getting him lost, and we'd show him a bit of the country, and we did the hippity-skippity version. John got as far as Hokitika and then found, oh, by this time, I might say, his good lady had joined him, that's Anne, and the two of them found out at this point of time that the plane stopped at Hokitika and there were no seats for John to carry on. So the net result was that they caught a taxi at Hokitika and they went up and over Arthur's Pass and saw a great deal more of the country and arrived at Christchurch, I'm told, at 10 to 7 for their 7 o'clock members meeting. So it was a very heavy day, that particular trip. He had some splendid lectures, 140 at Christchurch. He took a little time off and went up and saw some Bart Baker. In the course of that, he got involved with the newspapers in Timaru. And I'm told, I'm looking forward to seeing it, but I'm told he gave a splendid address, no, it's not quite the word, interview to the Timaru, what is it, Herald or Tribune, whatever the paper is, on trees. So I'm looking forward to reading his expertise on trees. Being some Bart Baker guest, he couldn't do anything else.
I hope I could do anything else.
He went on from there to Dunedin, Dunedin to Invercargill. Had a couple of days at Invercargill to see Manapouri and Milford. It rained, I might say, but he tells me it was made all the more beautiful with the waterfalls. He came back through Dunedin, up to Wellington again, did another lecture in Wellington, did an unscheduled visit to Levin, to the group there, went on to Whanganui, up to New Plymouth, gave a lecture at New Plymouth. Then he took only 3-4 days off and was our guest at the Easter camp at New Plymouth, and a couple of days ago he came back up to Auckland. His spare moments, I might say, have been filled in today. He's been interviewed by the TV folk, and that interview has been taped and is going to be played one Sunday shortly in one of the religious, is it,
yes,
sessions, and interviewed by Ian Watkins, who, whatever session that might be that he conducts. So look forward to seeing that. He's also had newspaper interviews today and all the other things. He's had splendid press. I'm reminded, actually, I've learned a lot of things about John, just little quiet things that I didn't know before. And I have here a letter which arrived only today from one of our southern lodgers. He gave an interview, a broadcast interview, and in it, they tell me, he was a Presbyterian, Oxford grouper, and investigated spiritualism before becoming a theosophist. I didn't know that. As a child, he lived in the family home, which was a castle in Scotland, and there were two ghosts.
Far more than two.
Well, that's what this says. One, a footman who had been murdered and wandered in an area of the castle, trying the doors. The other was a woman who kept going up and down some stairs.
Quite true, both of them.
The castle is now a tourist hotel, and the proprietor wrote to Mr. Coates asking how did they keep their staff, that is the family, because his will not stay. So there's something else I learned about John. He's given a lot of interviews. He's had innumerable radio sessions, and has really, over a course of 6 weeks, had a very, very busy time. John, we are most indebted to you for all that you've done. I'm quite certain that John will be more than happy to stop talking now. He's been addressing groups 1 and 2 a day in some places and giving impromptu talks. He very kindly gave an address in most places to the members before the public lecture, so it was like 2 lectures. On the same occasion, and he really has done a magnificent job for the society here in New Zealand. I'm delighted to say the Society has responded magnificently. They've attended in their hordes, the members and the public, and we are more than delighted with the response that his visit has attracted in this country, and I think New Zealand has done John credit. He's off back now to Australia to rejoin Betsan over in Brisbane, and I'm not quite sure just how long he has, but he has a day or two's rest, I believe, up there, 2 days rest, and then he's off around Australia again. So he leads a very, very busy life and devotes it entirely to the cause of the society right throughout the world. From Australia, he goes back to India, and then he's off back to the Pacific Conference at Indonesia, and so it goes on around the world, perpetual motion. John, thank you very much indeed on behalf of all these good folk and all the members right throughout the New Zealand section for all that you have done. And please take back with you the very good wishes of all New Zealand members to the society wherever you might go.
I'll do that. Thank you very, very much. To me, it's been a wonderful opportunity. And I would like, in my turn, to bring you the greetings of all our people at Adyar. We look to you as you look to us in friendship and happiness and brotherhood. And particularly, I should mention our then Vice President Joy Mills, who's coming here at the end of this year, I think. She wrote the other day and asked me to convey her greetings to you all, which I'm happy to do. It's been a wonderful time. Thank you for all you've said. I don't deserve it. I've enjoyed myself very much with all of the people here, and I'm looking forward to next time.
Ask Joan to come forward and play for us this the music for Light More Light.
This we sang this at the centenary convention in New York, the Congress there, at the period during the meeting which we held, at the time when we imagined that Colonel Olcott might have been giving his inaugural address when the society was opened 100 years before. And we had about 500 people in the room there at that Congress, and we really made good noise, the 500 people singing this. Was it more like 800? More like 800? Oh, well, I didn't know exactly how many. But many hundreds were gathered for this rather special meeting, which I think was rather a unique occasion for all of those who attended it. And it has become, since then, a sort of anthem, which is very frequently used in theosophical circles. All over Europe it's used quite a lot, and in various other places. And so, although we're not 800 here, I hope you can make a good noise. And I think you know the words, and you know the tune, which is from Beethoven's Ninth Symphony.